Okay, so continuing this chapter about noise and electromagnetic compatibility. So last time we were talking about noise and noise sources and how to quantify noise. We had this signal to noise ratio defined. Another metric for noise is noise figure, which is actually a metric for an amplifier or some other circuit that kind of defines the quality of the amplifier or the circuit in terms of the noise. So how much noise it brings in itself to the signal. So simple definition of noise figure is as usual we are dealing with in logarithmic terms, so in decibels or decibel type of units. But the noise figure is by definition is the noise output of a power noise output power of, for from an amplifier divided by the if you have a noiseless amplifier that basically the ratio of the real circuit. So we have some noise already at the input of an amplifier or the circuit. It might not be amplifier, it can be also just a filter or some other type of circuit that the signal goes through. But if you think about the signal it at the input, signal at the output, there is the noise from the original source of the signal, but then along the way, the amplifier itself or the circuit brings in its own contribution of noise. So if we take that and then we take just kind of a ideal amplification and check how much noise there is without the contribution of that particular amplifier, then that's the noise figure. And of course, this should be as small as possible. So if you have 1-to-1 ratio, so basically it means that the amplifier or the circuit doesn't bring anything, then our noise figure is zero. And that's kind of the definition, but then how to kind of quantify it actually, then what we do is that we measure the kind of we measure the frequency spectrum of the signal before and after, and then we check what's the ratio of those. So this VN is the noise RMS noise from the measurement. So I said, if you have a perfect amplifier noise without any noise, then the noise figure is zero. But then, in reality, that's not the case. So a good low noise amplifier has noise figures of, let's say, 2 or 3 decibels. So it brings in noise, but in considering the noise from the original source, it's not that big in respect to that. Okay, then some words about designing a low noise application. So as already discussed earlier, if you think about an amplifier, which amplifies signals, so it amplifies all the signals. It just doesn't amplify the signal that we want, but it amplifies all the signals. Of course, there are the higher frequency signals. They are cut off, and depending on what is the low, if it's an AC coupled amplifier, then it of course it cuts the low frequency parts to a certain extent. But nonetheless, in the passband, it amplifies the actual signal that we are interested in and also the noise parts. And as said, the amplifier itself brings in some noise contributions. And depending on which stage of the amplifier the noise is produced. So if it's in the input stage, then of course it goes through the whole through the amplification and it gets amplified and the total contribution is higher. And then if it's at the output stage, then it doesn't get amplified and then the noise figure is better. So usually kind of roughly speaking, the noise generated in the first stages of the amplifier in the input stage and the first parts determines the overall noise performance of the whole system. And also the source resistance plays a role. So meaning the source is the source of the signal source. Which in terms of noise, there is some optimization that can be done. So if we think about the signal source, it has some noise sources, but as we talked, the short noise and thermal noise and so on. So if we can quantify those, then we can kind of optimize that if we can tune the source resistance some way, then it should be like the optimal resistance to kind of minimize the noise would be the noise voltages, so thermal noise, 1 over F noise to the square divided by the basically the short noise currents to the square and square root of that. So it's basically just the noise voltages divided by noise currents. And because we are dealing with uncorrelated quantities, then we have these squares, so it's not kind of direct division. So in some cases it can play a role. So especially if we have several different voltage noise sources, then we have to have this square instead of just summation as we discussed earlier. Okay, so for bipolar amplifiers, the noise voltages and noise currents, so the short noise and the thermal noises and so on, they increase with the collector current. So in order to have a bipolar based amplifier and good low noise version of it, then we should kind of design it so that it had the quiescent currents should be rather low. So some in orders of microamperes. So that we kind of minimize the voltage and current noises. So that's kind of the rule of thumb, how to get to low noises. But then if you think about field effect transistors, they are dominated by the volts, like the noise voltage from the thermal no noise source. So this Johnson noise, because we have usually the field effect transistors. It's there's this, the resistance of the channel is the one where that thermal noise is originating, and the resistance goes down the higher the current is. So in for these JFETs, they kind of it's the opposite in order to get low noise application. So in a field effect transistor, you would like to have high current, the drain current, high drain current, and then you have kind of you have minimized the noise contribution. So that's kind of the rough distinction between field effect transistors and bipolar for low noise applications. Okay, that was about the kind of the noise and the kind of the intrinsic kind of an intrinsic physical noise that it's inside the devices and materials and so on. But then we have this electromagnetic compatibility, which is about the fact that we are surrounded by all kinds of sources of electromagnetic rubbish, so to speak. So you have a lot of noise around us that you cannot hear them, but from electronics point of view, it would be something like that you are in a construction site. And there's a lot of drills and machinery working, and there's a lot of hassle, and you would try to concentrate on your job, whatever that is, and there's a lot of distraction. So electromagnetic point of view, you have a lot of in different frequencies, a lot of stuff happening. You have all the Wi-Fis, you have the 50 hertz mains inside the buildings, walls, that all things contribute to the overall electromagnetic noise that comes all over the place. And depends on where you are, there's less noise than the other parts. So where there are more and more electric appliances, there is more and more kind of distractions for the systems to work. So now this electromagnetic compatibility is something that you need to take into account when you design equipment and systems, so that you can make a design and a system that can operate even though there would be some level of electromagnetic noise around. So some examples where these EMC or EM EMI, so electromagnetic interference, can originate from, and how to kind of take that into account. So we have power lines, power grid that can.
To function properly, even
Excuse me.
in ah, anteeksi.
Ah, no worries. So the power grid can affect the systems depending on the distance. So the closer you are to the power, you can already sense that with some like radios, for example. If you drive or you go underneath a power lines with a normal radio, you probably have problems hearing the radio signal properly. So these kind of things, and depending on how sensitive your system is, that then you might have even more problems. Then inside your system itself, so you have different parts. So you have power supplies, you have amplifiers, you have actuators, and things. They can interfere with each other. So that's also something that of course, that's up to you how you have made the system, and that's kind of up to the designer that can take that into account. But the thing is that it's not that easy to simulate those effects. There are some tools that you can use to simulate these electromagnetic interferences and compatibility issues, but that it's not always really simple thing, because it also the surroundings can make an effect, and the casing. What kind of casing you have your system in, and so on. Which is of course the case as well for the external sources. So if you have a system your that you have planned, and you have if you're working on only so that it's kind of an open bare die or bare circuit board, there's more interference to that. In comparison to the if you would put a aluminum casing, for example, which would shield some of the electromagnetic spectrum, and you wouldn't have that much of problems. And another thing about EMC is not only that your system can operate properly in the environment where there's electromagnetic interference, but also that your system has to be designed so that it doesn't produce interference to other systems. So you are not the kind of the pollution source, or your system is not the source for electromagnetic noises. So that's also something that needs to be taken care of. And there, if you would design a commercial systems that would be sold to consumers, then you would that system and that appliance, that equipment needs to go through a certification procedure that where these kind of things are checked, that it passes those qualifications, that they don't produce too much of noise. There are certain limits for that, and there are certain standards that you need to take into account. So this electromagnetic interference that is surrounding us, and more nowadays, because everything is electronic and we have electricity used in many places, and we have a lot of power used in many places. So these sources are not, and we have this different Wi-Fi and different mobile technologies coming into the existence, and increasingly you think about 5G, for example. The idea is that because 5G needs rather good coverage and short distances, so there would be a lot of these transmitters, 5G or transceivers, all over the place. So there will be a lot more and more of these electromagnetic interference sources from that. And so, as many things can be, that this electromagnetic interference can be natural or human-made. So, of course, these human-made sources that continues to grow, and the natural ones are more or less steady. So there are some fluctuations, obviously, but the average amount of natural sources doesn't increase that rapidly as the human-made sources does. So natural sources of interference, the most obvious ones are lightning, solar emissions, and cosmic radiation. Of course, the latter two are not that strong, but they are still there, and depends on where you are and what type of sensitivity your system has, then you might have those can affect. But lightning is one thing that affects quite obviously. So if there's a thunderstorm and a lot of lightning, then the electric appliances can get affected. So that probably many of us has encountered or have made some precautions, that if there is, especially in the countryside, where it's quite normal that if there's a thunderstorm, that people take like unplug their TV and radio from the wall, just to avoid that they might break because of a lightning strike nearby. So the human-made sources is more evident and stronger, because we build things and we put these type of things everywhere, and but then we just have to take care of that we don't interfere too much with the surroundings. But of course that's not always the case, that there can be some interferences that can cause problems. So if you think that what are the common sources of problems is, if you think at the automotive ignition system, so when the spark plugs, so there's a small lightnings in the spark plugs all the time, so they they irradiate electromagnetic waves. So that needs to take into account when building in a car with all kinds of electronic sensitive electronics in it. So those spark plugs, which are inherently there, if you think about normal combustion engine, then that it needs to be shielded properly, that those EM waves cannot interfere with the rest of the system. Not only your car, but the other cars as well. Electric motors can also, so there are, whenever you have a switching system, so whenever you are switching a current on and off, because the electromagnetic waves originate from acceleration and deceleration of charge. So that's basically the main source of electromagnetic waves. Well, basically the only source. So if you boil down to it, that's where the electromagnetic radiation comes from. So whenever an electron is accelerated or decelerated, there's some electromagnetic radiation emitted from that process. So all these sources, industrial plants, so we have motors there running and all kinds of other high power gadgets that can, so switching on and off currents, and mobile telephones, well, that's obvious that those transmit and they receive electromagnetic radiation, but some of them, depending on the wavelengths, so the frequency, they can of course interfere with some other systems which are operating at that or can receive those same frequencies. So basically all electronic systems can cause these electromagnetic interferences. And another kind of, well, there are some other physical phenomena that can also produce electromagnetic interference, which are not exactly or directly electromagnetic phenomena, or you would not think of them as electromagnetic phenomena. Thing is this electrostatic discharge. So if you are, especially in the winter time when air is dry, you have a woolen sweater on you and you are walking in a plastic carpet and you touch a doorknob, for example, there can be this kind of a small lightning that you get the electric shock. You probably everyone has felt that at some point. And this is a problem when you are dealing with electric and electronics, especially when you have electronic circuit boards and also just components. So if you have delicate components, for example, if you would just from everyday life, if you would be building a computer from parts, the instructions say that you have to take care of this ESD protection. So you need to be grounded well, so that if you're building a computer to yourself and you have these processors and memories and whatever, and you are not taking this into account, you might break something. So you might find out that the processor doesn't work because you have broke it due to the fact that you have, during winter time, that there's air is dry, so you build up electricity, so you build up charge into yourself, and then you discharge it through your fingers to that processor, and it might fry some of the transistors, and then it's dead. So this has happened many times, and also some other devices when dealing with them or operating with them, you might break them unintentionally. So you don't know, you don't realize that there might be so that you don't even feel that electric shock, but it's there, and you kind of unintentionally and you don't know that you there was this ESD happening. So this is something that you need to take into account when working with electronics. So about the susceptibility of electromagnetic radiation. So the interference can enter to the system via conduction. So really by physical connection, so that you actually touch or the conductors touch or there's actual physical connection from the charged system to this the other system that kind of, so we have to have them close by. But then the other one is radiation. So this radiation is inducing these currents and voltages into your system. So even the source is far away and there's nothing is touching to each other and still they can interfere with each other. Rule of thumb is that if you think about frequencies, so relatively low frequencies, so below 30 megahertz or so, the conduction is the dominant mechanism. So at those frequencies, you have to be kind of close by and actual physical connection. So that's the dominated mechanism, the conduction. And then when we go above that, then the radiation gets more significant. So there's more and more radiation-induced fields and currents in inside the systems. So here is some illustration about this coupling and how the different parts of the system itself can interfere with each other and through which mechanisms. So power supply, usually they are these kind of on-off. There are some on-off operations happening. So currents are going on and off, or there are some like 50 hertz frequencies, which can be rectified to DC, but still at some point of the power supply, you have this changing currents and which emit radiation. So not only this radiation can go through the or within these cables, but also the radiated noise that can then go much further and other systems as well. So power supplies are usually kind of the one of the major or the first things that you need to take into account and properly design in order to not to produce this EMI. Then within the signal lines, so you have signal lines that have AC signals, for example, then if they are close by and the capacitance and inductance between those lines is kind of matching properly or inappropriately, so that there's actually the AC signal from one signal line can couple and induce currents and voltages in the other one. And it then that's noise for the so two signal lines. One is carrying some signal and data, and the other one is carrying some other data. And if the data basically it can jump between those two and interfere with the other with each others, then that's noise, and that's something that needs to be taken care of in the design phase. Then obviously from the actuators and the sensors, they can have noise which then propagate to your system. Then within the system, we have these so-called ground loops. So different parts of the system are connected to the ground at different places, and there can be some potential differences that can produce some currents between different parts of the system, and that produces noise. So So there's a lot of sources that can produce problems in the systems. And it's basically, it's kind of an experience type of thing that you need to learn by doing, which one is the, of course, there are some literature explaining and obvious things that you, what needs to be taken care of in order to minimize the noise. But usually these are things that you first do, and then you find out, okay, there's a lot of noise. What should I do if I, and then you do it slightly differently. You learn, okay, it helped or it didn't help. It got worse. And then you do iterations that how to get better and better in terms of noise. Okay, I basically the rule of thumb is that in order to make a proper EMC design so that you minimize especially the high frequency noise like problems, is that you pay attention to the conductors, the length and the geometry of the conductor. So basically, in order to reduce the EMC so that it doesn't couple to your system, then you have as short as possible wires between different parts of your system, and also you pay attention that there you kind of maximize the distance within your circuit board between different parts or different signal lines. Of course, there are some limits that you cannot make them too far apart, because you will run out of space. So there are not that much of a decrease of freedom, but you can still do something. And there, of course, it's always an optimization that how you optimize it so that it's as less as possible of noise problems, but it's still functional in other ways, and it's still kind of, you can make it the circuit board in a factory, or if it's just a one time board, then that you can make it without too many problems in the process. So circuit design, some rough guidelines is that if you think about the wiring, so if you make wires in a circuit board, it's rather easy to produce this kind of loop. So if you think about the circuit schematics that we have been dealing with all the time in the kind of the, when we are learning how things work, they look like this. And if you would make exactly similar circuits, then we start having these loops which act as antennas. So this kind of a loop, it can pick up electromagnetic radiation, and that electromagnetic radiation would induce currents that would not be there otherwise. And of course, that's noise from the operating point of view for this circuit. So you would need to take into account these and try to minimize all these type of loops. Ribbon cables, for example, depending on how the different wires in a ribbon cable are used. So if you have, like here, you have a ribbon cable that the topmost wire is taken from the sensor. It goes to your sensor or the kind of a amplifier input states, and then the grounding is taken from the other like part of the ribbon cable. Then you produce this kind of a big loop that acts again as an antenna, which can pick up signals from which are coming from wherever. So these things need to be taken into account. So here's one illustration of bad and slightly better design. So you have some systems, whatever systems they are operational amplifiers, whatever, and in a circuit board. So you have here many of them. And then you bring in the supply voltage, 5 volts in this case, to each of them. And then you ground each of them to 0 volt like this. And if you look at here, then you produce these loops. Here is a loop, here is a loop, here is a loop. So there's several loops that then can act as an antenna to pick up noise. So better way to have it like this, so you kind of make a grid so for example, on the top plate of a circuit board, you bring in the 5 volts, and the bottom plate, you bring in the 0 volt. There are these loops now, but if you, or these grids, and you have a loop here, but on top of a positive loop, this 5 volt, there's this 0 volt loop here. And this type of thing, if you remember, if there would be electromagnetic radiation that would induce some voltage or current in this black triangle here, it would produce the same amount of or almost the same amount of on the gray one, and they would cancel each other out. So they, because they are on top of each other, so this is better. Of course, there are some problems in this case. It's not noise free, but it's better than the left circuit schematic. So how to partition and ground the circuit? There are, of course, you always need to pay attention to the ground. So the grounding, how to ground circuits, that's very essential in terms of noise. Of course, for other reasons as well, but especially for the noise, you can do a lot of harm if you don't pay attention to how the grounding is done. So if you have different systems and you would like, or every time you have a conductor, it has some finite impedance or finite resistance in it. And if you would just have a subsystem, in this case C, and you would connect that with the wire to the grounding plate or grounding like reference of B, and then this B grounding is connected to the subsystem A's grounding, and then you, that A is then grounded to the kind of a global ground, which is then in the wall or whatever. Then you have this kind of a problem that not the the potentials of each of the grounds in each system is not the same. There's some fluctuations and some differences, and depending on how the signals are, then the actual signals are fed from one system to another. Those signal lines are not shown in this case now, but that may pose problems with these potential differences, and also the fluctuations in the potentials can, because they are not equal, then you may have some unintentional currents flowing in and out from different systems. So better way would be that you find your global ground, whatever that is, and you connect all the systems directly to that. And then you would have these, the impedances of different systems and the grounding path. Of course, they are not always exactly the same, but if depending on how you design and the geometry, what kind of wires you use and so on, they are close to the same. So then the potential differences between different subsystems is not that great as in the previous one. And then you have less problems. So, for example, if many times in slightly more complex circuit boards, you have analog, you have digital, and then you have noisy circuits like the power supply circuits in the same circuit. And if you ground them like this, and not like that you would select first one of these systems as a reference, and then you kind of go and use that as reference, and then it's better to have a global reference, which is not exactly this any particular system's reference. Then and kind of the rule of thumb is that this ground, as it's that's also slightly difficult thing to understand, and again it's kind of an experience type of thing, that what type of ground is good. So if you would like to really have a good ground, then you would need to have basically, like the name applies, the best way would be that you have a ball of copper put into the ground, a big chunk of copper put into the ground, and then you connect your wire to that. Then you are grounded. That's basically how it goes. But then, of course, that's not always the possible way. So, like in the laboratory, like we have in certain places, we have this kind of a grounding, grounding rails. So some metals there, which is connected to a proper ground, which is not noise free, but the noise in that ground is minimized, so that it's connected properly to actual rod, which is on the ground. And then when you use that grounding rail as your reference, then you can be more sure that your system's ground is stable and not fluctuating with some, for any reason. But of course, there are more levels of grounding. So depending on what is the kind of the global ground for any given system, they are not always the same. But of course, if you are hooking up different systems together, then you should find out and make sure that they have a common ground and not different grounds, because then you might have problems. Then the grounding loop is, even if you would make it like in the picture shown in the previous slides, still at certain frequencies you start having, and depending on how you connect different parts of your module, for example, to the global ground. So like illustrated on the left-hand picture, that as said, all the wires and conductors, they possess some impedance. And depending on how the geometry and how they actually physically kind of are laid out, there can be some loops. And if there are some potential differences and impedance differences, you can have some loops that produce unintentional currents and voltages inside your system. Which, of course, it depends on how sensitive your application is, and you probably can work, it can operate without too many problems. But of course, when you are going more and more sensitive, doing more and more sensitive things, censoring stuff, then these types of things start to rise there in the signal. Also, if you have this star-like grounding scheme, still you might have some kind of stray capacitance from one system to the ground, which at high frequencies, this start to be contributing to these grounding currents, ground loop currents, and may pose some problems in some applications. So these are just the things that you need to, if you start having problems, then these are the ones that you can start thinking of, that maybe the problem is because of this type of thing. So it's difficult to think ahead too many things regarding these noise and electromagnetic interference, because some applications, they are not that sensitive, and you don't need to put much effort. You need to put some effort to the grounding stuff, but they can work pretty okay. But then if it's more and more sensitive, then you build a system and then you start having problems. And then you need to know what type of sources there are. And then you can kind of start looking at your system, that how it's physically laid out, whether there are these kind of looping problems in the grounding scheme. So here is a illustration that you have a ground plate. So in a circuit board, for example, many times if you have two-sided circuit board, for example, of course there are systems or applications where you need more and more layers of copper that you make this kind of multi-layer circuit board. But in kind of a semi-simple circuit boards, you can one-sided board is for very simple stuff. Then two-sided is something that you can already you use the other side as grounding plate. So it's kind of common ground for all the stuff that are on the other side of the board, and then you connect all the grounds to that plate through the board, and then you have relatively good grounding scheme for your system. So there is not many places that the electromagnetic radiation can couple to the system, because you are having this kind of a good grounding plate and using as short leads as possible from the subsystem reference to that kind of a global ground. Then you minimize all the coupling problems. Cable shielding, which is probably the first thing that you can note and easiest to illustrate, you will probably, well, I guess you already in part A lab work, you could have seen this using different types of cable and different lengths and different geometries for cable. You can kind of produce noise, and you can see the minimization that if you reduce the length of the cable, you can see that okay, now it performs better than a long cable. So if you have just a single cable, like on the topmost picture, you have a single source, and then you have a destination, which is the amplifier or whatever, how you read the signal. This can pick up a lot of noise, especially if you have a long cable, and then you make if you would have this kind of some sort of loop or half a loop, then it just picks up a lot of noise. Improvement is, which is typically used, is just a simple coaxial cable. So you you connect the grounds of these two in the shielding of the cable, and the signal itself goes inside the cable, so that this kind of configuration doesn't pick up noise as much as. So this is quite widely used in the laboratory to move. You can move with the signal quite far distances with this, and without having too much noise picked up. Then of course these coaxial cables, they are physically quite thick, so they are not that easy to, so you can move one or two signals, but then if you would like to have more signals, like a ribbon cable type of thing, otherwise the size for the cables is limited, so you cannot fit in thick cables, then you need to do something else. And one relatively efficient way is to have a twisted pair like this. So you kind of take two cables and you twist them, and then you still have loops. But think how this works is that the loop here, for example, if you think that that electromagnetic radiation would couple to this loop, then it would produce, let's say it would produce a current that because this basically acts as a coil. So it's basically a coil that what we are dealing with. So it has inductance. So change the magnetic field will induce current in this wire. So let's say that it would induce a current that flows to the right on the top part of this part here. Then that current would flow on the to the right on the bottommost current lead here. And if you think about the electromagnetic wave or the radiation that comes in, it will affect more or less the same amount to this loop and this loop. So in this loop, then it would couple the same way, and it would induce kind of currents that would kind of be opposite direction to the currents that was induced on the left hand loop. So in this kind of schematic or configuration, the electromagnetic coupling is reduced compared to the one that if these two wires would go parallel and not twisted. So that's why this twisted pair is kind of good for, or better choice for, it's not as good as the coaxial, but it's still improvement for from a single or parallel cables. And improvement from this twisted pair is the screened twisted pair. So you have this twisted pair cable, and you shield it with kind of a coaxial cable type, that you have this crown shield here. So then it reduces the coupling of the electromagnetic radiation to these loops. So this is improvement. So, and this is quite commonly used for example, the Ethernet cables. You have basically two twisted pairs, so you have four cables inside, two twisted pairs there, and then you have a shield around all of them. So it's relatively good shielding against, and you can pull those lines and cables quite far distances without having much of EMI or EMC problems. Okay, key points for this chapter is that we have various forms of noise: thermal noise, shot noise, and 1/F noise, and then the electromagnetic interference that all can pose problems in the electronic systems. And practically all components, all systems suffer from this noise and EMI. And it's just a matter of how the signal to noise ratio is something that you can pay attention to. So many of the things that we do in the simplest form, we don't have to worry too much about any of the noise sources or EMI, but it can start be a problem when we do more complicated systems and more delicate systems. And the circuit board, the layout plays quite a big role determining this EMC performance. So you can make a lot of harm, even for a simple system, you can make a lot of harm if you place the conductors, the wires in a wrong way. Then you couple more and more of the unintentional signals that you don't need there. So that's something to pay attention to. Okay, then next chapter. Just slightly behind the schedule, we have still two chapters to go. So positive feedback. We have been talking about feedback in the past. And namely, we've been talking about the negative feedback and the kind of the positive sides of that. So advantages of negative feedback. So we can get rid of or reduce the effects of the variability of different characteristics of the active components with negative feedback. But then what about positive feedback? We've been kind of considering that as something to avoid, But there are some applications that you can use the positive feedback as your as an advantage and as kind of a tool. So we will talk about oscillators and also the stability of systems. So where are the limits and how you can define the limits for systems when they are stable and when they are not. So as said, we've been discussing about negative feedback, and now we will go look into how the positive feedback, and you can use them in both analog and digital circuits in a way, but primarily this positive feedback is used to produce oscillators. So when you have positive feedback, there's a certain configuration in the circuit that it starts to oscillate, and you can actually make an oscillator using that feature. Of course, in some systems you would avoid that oscillation and any type of oscillation, and that then we are also talking about the stability. So if you want to make a stable design, stable circuit that doesn't, it kind of produces a well-behaving output without any oscillations, but then at certain frequencies you have some oscillation or certain temperatures or certain parameter space you have oscillations, then we are talking about stability of that system. So we will look into that as well. So where to start from? So if you remember, the generalized feedback system was given as such here with this negative feedback. So we have the forward path transfer function for an amplifier, for example, this A. Then we have a feedback path where the transfer function is B. And then we take a negative, so we subtract that feedback path from the input. And the closed loop gain, the G was defined as A over 1 plus AB. So if we have, there should be minus over here. So when AB is minus 1, then this denominator goes to 0 and the gain is practically infinite for this ideal case. And that's actually the condition for oscillation. So then it starts to oscillate. So every other, if you think that that when we start from the input, whatever that is, then we multiply it by A, and then we take it back, or we multiply that with B and actually sum it to here, and next time it's much higher, and then we kind of it goes to the kind of infinite loop that it kind of just wobbles back and forth up and down, because of this, that it doesn't decide and it's not stable. So for oscillation, for this generalized feedback system, there's this so-called Barkhausen criterion. And it says that the loop gain AB must be, the magnitude for this loop gain should be 1, and the phase shift of the loop gain should be 180 degrees. So it should be minus 1. Or 180 degree plus minus n times 360. So it can also happen that actually the phase shift is not only it's pointing in the complex diagram. It's pointing to the left, so it's imaginary. It's real, but it's pointing to the left, so it has this minus sign. But it can also be in system so that actually the phase shift is multitude of 360. So it's not only like halfway, but it has gone actually 1.5 times around the origo. But that's kind of a specialized case usually. Okay, how to make this kind of thing happen? So in the simplest case, or in a passive with the passive components, you can make a phase shift of 180 degrees happening using a ladder, RC ladder network. So you remember that this kind of high pass filter, if you just take one of these high pass filter, it at low frequencies it produces a 90 degree phase shift when you go really low frequencies. If you take a second one, the output is converging towards 180 degrees at low frequencies, but it's diverging to that and basically never reaches it. But then you take third one, then basically at low frequencies, it converges to 270 degrees. So at some point at low frequencies, you have this point where you have 180 degree phase shift with three stages. And of course, if you put more and more of these stages, you have at some point, you will have a point where you have 180 degree phase shift. So if you now look at this ladder system or ladder network with three identical RC stages, or C, we have C, three capacitors and three resistors, which are identical. And then we would look at what is the transfer function. So what is the voltage gain for that system? So if you go through the, I won't go through the derivation, I will just give you the result. So it boils down to this looking like this. So we have 1 over 1 minus 5 times, 5 over omega RC squared minus J. So we have real part and imaginary part of this this system. And if you would like to show it differently, this is one way of showing it. So we have this imaginary part. So J omega here times RC to the third power. So these are, sorry, these two are equal, but the upper part is just kind of boiled down to the kind of so that you can see in the denominator, you can see the real part and the imaginary part. But this can be used, the bottom part can be used for if you would like to use some control system tools and find out how this thing works for border plotting and step functions and so on. So but that's something that you will learn if you go to this control system course, which is held by Timo Sajavaara. Where it gets this 180 degree phase shift, basically it's when this part, the imaginary part, goes to zero. And that happens when the frequency is 1 over 2 pi RC and square root of 6. And what is the voltage gain for this system is minus 1 over 29. So when you plug in this frequency, of course, in omega to here, then what it comes down to, you will get minus 1 over 29. Okay, so we have a ladder system, or we could use this as a feedback path for amplifier and get an oscillator. We will show it that in a minute. So if we would now plot that RC ladder in a border plot, so magnitude and phase, so accurately, if you look at it, it's giving the phase shift is minus 180 degrees here. So it doesn't matter if it's minus 180 degree or plus, because it's still pointing. So it's minus sign still. So that's minus 29. And it's in decibels. It's something, I don't know exactly how much it's in decibels. I don't remember. But anyhow, and the estimate here, I will show you that in a minute where that comes from. So if you would do an estimate, it doesn't really give the same value. And the estimate is that we cannot treat that RC ladder simply by taking a single high pass filter and multiply it three times. So it doesn't give us the accurate value or accurate transfer function or accurate voltage gain. Because I think we already discussed this, but if you would think that if you take just a single one and then you think that, okay, what is the voltage at here? It's just simply the voltage division between these two components, and then you go to the next stage and you do the same, and the next stage, then you neglect the effect of the second stage and the impedance of the second stage, which is parallel with the resistor of the first stage. And you need to take that into account, and then it kind of reduces to this formula here. So that's why you cannot use simply this one. And if you would use this, then you would be off by this much. So you would think that the 180 degree would happen at this point, and the amplitude is something like, so you would be off in the frequency and off in the amplitude if you would make the estimate. So you have to take it, make it accurately. Okay, phase shift oscillator is that basically what you do is then you take this into a amplifier which has a gain of 29, and then you feed back that signal here, and because it's the gain is minus 1/29, and you have this differential amplifier here, then minus minus, that's plus, and then you sum the signal. And now in this case, you don't even need to have any signal practically, because you are kind of only needs a some noise here, and it will pick up that frequency from that noise, and it will start oscillating at the output. And now if you look at the border plot for this, so the input has now taken from, so we put some signal source here and going to sweep that in frequency and see how it behaves, and it would look like this. So there is this point in frequency which is the oscillator RC ladder's frequency when it gets wild. So it kind of, at that point, the total transfer function goes to infinity in ideal case. And that's where it starts to oscillate. Of course, the output doesn't go to infinity, because we have in real life, of course, we always have some limits, but it will start oscillate, and that's the frequency of the oscillation. And now if we would think how it would look like, so if we would have for the forward path gain, the A, controlled, then if the A would be less than 29, then we would have this blue oscillation. There would be still oscillation. So at the start, we have just simply put a impulse. So we just put a short impulse, and it will take from that impulse kind of the starting point and it start kind of oscillating. And it will start oscillating, but as you can see, the amplification or the voltage gain for the forward path is not enough to hold the oscillation. So it starts to fade away. So if you wait long enough, the output goes to zero. So it didn't go oscillating. So it's still somewhat unstable, but it doesn't work as an oscillator yet. If you have it exactly 29, then it starts to oscillate, and it keeps that amplitude practically forever. So it's just on the limit. So it's unstable, and it's oscillates as we want. So then we can tune the frequency by tuning these RC values. If the A is too high, then it starts to oscillate, but then it starts to kind of diverge, and it got just the amplitude just grows and grows and grows and grows and grows, and it's eventually it of course in the if we think about in reality, we will hit some kind of maximum, and it will probably start cutting the signal. So we would have operational amplifier, for example, it's the y-axis amplitude, the units are arbitrary in this case, just to illustrate the effect. But at some point, we will have the maximum voltage reached from the amplifier itself, and then we will cut the signal. It doesn't oscillate as nicely as we want. So this is kind of the critical point. There's just one value for amplification when this gets kind of perfect oscillation behavior. If you are off, if you are slightly too low, then it dies down. If it slightly too high, it will start expanding and increasing the amplitude more and more. Another type of oscillator is so-called Wien bridge oscillator, which is shown here. So now we have this input is now just for the oscillator, for the feedback path that we are now building. So we have in series RC network and parallel RC network, and then we look at what is the output of this system here regarding the input. And if we can now go through the derivation, which I'm not showing in detail, but what we find out is that it boils down to this kind of formula that it's 1 over 3 minus J, and inside the imaginary we have 1 minus an omega squared R squared C squared over omega RC. And now we can see that the imaginary part vanishes when we have this part here zero, which means that the frequency at which this oscillates is 1 over RC, which is, of course, it requires that R1 is equal to R2 and C1 is equal to C2. So they are identical components. Then it reduces to this. And the total gain, when the imaginary part in the denominator is zero, then we have the voltage gain is 1 over 3. And you can see that this produces a phase shift of zero. So it's not 180 degrees, it's zero. But now if we use an inverting amplifier, the inverting amplifier itself produces 180 degree phase shift. Then we can use this as an oscillator. So if you now produce a circuit like this, where we have an operational amplifier, and then we feed back this signal here, and we have a voltage gain tuned here with R2 and an R1, which is roughly 2 times R2, then the amplification of this part here is roughly 3, and it should be exactly 3 in order to have this system work as a oscillator. And here's a simulation of how it looks like. Again, we have, so the x-axis is now frequency times the time constant RC. So here's we have that oscillation frequency happening at x equals 1. So we can see that there's this resonant peak over here. So as said, the amplitude stabilization is a key when if you want to make a good oscillator. So of course, as shown in the previous slide or few slides back, when you have this, if the four-path gain is not exactly what we want, then we either the amplitude is dying, so fading, in time, or it starts to expand and it kind of hits to the wall and ceiling. So what to do? We would need to some means of stabilizing the magnitude of the oscillation to cope with the variability of the gain of the circuit, because the gain of the circuit can vary with temperature. It can vary for various reasons, and of course if it starts to vary and it at some point the temperature goes high and it makes the gain too low and it dies the oscillation, or it goes too high and it kind of expand or oscillation saturates, then we need to find a way how to deal with that. If you can now consider the Wien bridge oscillator, so we could replace the variable resistor R1, which was in the feedback path of the operator amplifier, to the in the inverting input. If we would change that into a thermistor and make the design and value, chose the values of R1 and R2 in a way that at normal room temperature, the gain is slightly greater than what it, so it's in this case it would be slightly above 3, the value for that gain. So that means that the oscillation would start to kind of the amplitude would start to rise, and it would start to increase. But then what it means, because we take that amplitude, we take that voltage back, and the current goes through the resistor or this thermistor, this R1. So there's higher current going through R1, and the higher current, it will start heating up that thermistor. And in thermistor, what happens when it heats up, the resistance goes down, and it will reduce the gain of the circuit, and then the amplitude goes down, and it will find a proper stable point when there's current flowing through. It heats up, but it heats up it just enough to be at the certain right level of voltage or the gain. So R1 divided by R2 is right in the correct value. So then with this way, it gets stable. So even though the temperature would move, then there is this kind of thermal feedback in addition to these electrical feedbacks that are inherently in this system. But there's this kind of thermal feedback that kind of takes care of that this gain remains at the right position. Because otherwise you would be, if you would put a variable resistor, you would need to tune that all the time by yourself. And then of course, that would be a painful thing to do that. Okay, you would find out, okay, now the amplitude is growing too much. I need to tune it to the right. Now it's fading. I need to turn it to the left. And then it would be problematic from the user point of view. So this is a clever trick to avoid that type of thing. So the previous oscillators, they produce sinusoidal output. Of course, the amplitude stabilization problems might produce some distortion to the sinusoid. It might not be perfect sinusoidal, so it's looks like sinusoidal, but it's not exactly a sine wave. But we can also use positive feedback to make a digital oscillators. And let's see some examples. So if you would make a so-called relaxation oscillator. So in the heart of this, there is again operational amplifier where we have limits for the output is for the operational amplifier, the limits for the output is the positive and negative supply voltages. So if you have, let's say, positive 5, negative 5, then at the output we have maximum 5 and minimum minus 5. And if we make this kind of circuit around it, then we have here on the inverting side, we have a resistor which kind of has a feed and the feedback path from the output and a capacitor. And now we have a RC circuit here that whenever this output is high, like here, it's high, then there is a current flowing to this point. And because of this RC constant, so this capacitor starts to charge itself. So these points start to rise, so it doesn't jump to some value immediately. It starts to accumulate charge here, so the voltage at this point starts to grow up, and then it needs some time. And then when it reaches, because here we have at the bottom part, it's always halfway of the output. So if the output is positive, plus positive, then this non-inverting input is halfway. So whenever this inverting input reaches that point, then it flips. So because we remember the definition or the operational principle of operational amplifier, the output is high gain times V plus minus V minus. So whenever the differential is so if positive value, the V plus, so the non-inverting input is higher than the inverting input, then we have positive output, like hitting to the ceiling. And then whenever this inverting input is higher than the non-inverting input, then we are hitting to the floor. So we go to the negative. So depending on the capacitor and this resistor value, so the time constant, so this type of going back and forth in this inverting input signal, so this kind of a sawtooth-like signal, but at the output we are kind of jumping back and forth. And this is a digital oscillator. So now we have two stages, high and low. So it can be also 0 and 5 volts or 0 and 3 volts or depending on the logic that we are using. But nonetheless, we have two stages and nothing in between, but practically. So this is a digital oscillator, which is quite widely used in digital applications. Then the frequency stability is, of course, one key issue. So that when we are kind of however we choose the frequency for the oscillator, that it actually keeps that frequency and it doesn't wander around due to temperature or whatever reasons, that it actually keeps that particular frequency well. And the quality factor, which kind of relates to the quality factor that we were discussing in the when we were discussing the resonant frequency resonant circuits, it kind of comes from there. So basically how well we tune and how well we are at that frequency in that particular system. And for stable operations, there is this kind of materials, so-called piezoelectric materials, where the piezoelectric materials are such that when you press them, where you put external mechanical force to them, either pulling or pushing them, you get electrical signal. So there's some potential difference in the material from one side to another, and it depends on on the piezoelectric material itself, so how much pressure you need to put and which way the electrical signal comes from. And also, if you apply electric field to them, the materials start to deform. So you put electric field to them, they expand or they contract. So they go smaller or they go bigger. And so they are kind of both ways. So they are these kind of electromechanical materials called piezoelectric. And if you put alternating voltages to them, they start to vibrate. So if you put AC signal, they vibrate. And when you can make these, you can make them as such that you actually have this kind of a feedback system. Then you take electrical signal, which makes the crystal or the piezoelectric material to deform, and this deformation then induces electrical signal. Then it's fed back, and then when it kind of goes back and forth between two stages, then it can vibrate, and then it produces a vibration in the electrical signal. And these so-called crystals, which are made out of these piezoelectric materials, they have very high Q value. So they keep that, they have a certain, depending on the geometry and the size and shape and the material itself, they have their own kind of intrinsic frequency. And they keep it quite well. So it doesn't wonder. Say, of course, they are not like 100% always accurate, but they don't change too much. So they can change some per mil or some fraction of percent or something, but they are quite good for these type of things. And these are really widely used in processors and these kind of high frequency systems. Just a few words about the crystal still, or piezoelectric resonators, which are commonly referred to as crystals. So most commonly they are made of some ceramic materials like quartz, for example, which is just basically glass, but it of course it needs to be a certain type. So not probably all classes have some piezoelectric properties, but not all of them are good for these type of things. But these crystals and these resonators, they can be kind of modeled with this kind of equivalent circuit. So simple RLC resonator circuit, which can be kind of used as equivalent circuit. If you would analyze and simulate, you could use this type of circuit to emulate the behavior of such crystal. And here is still a kind of a schematic of how to use them. So you have an inverter. So this is just a simple inverter. So input signal high, output signal low, and when input signal low, then output signal high. And this resonator here kind of works the same way. So we have two. So this crystal here kind of affect or reacts to this low voltage here. It kind of produces low voltage here, and then it kind of goes the second way, high, low, high, and then it kind of just keeps kind of vibrating back and forth, and then it kind of produces this up and down signal at the output. And this output inverter here is just to, as a buffer, so the input impedance of this is really, really high, so that it doesn't affect this R and C and this oscillator and all these. So this kind of remains controlled with these capacitors and resistors, and you can tune the frequency to the proper frequency, which is also the crystal internal frequency. Okay, I will continue from the stability point of view next time, and we have still one chapter to go after that. So let's see. Let's hope that we can go through them all in a good manner. Any questions at this point? If not, then I will close this session, and we will see on Wednesday for the last lecture. Thank you all.